Welcome to Yes Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games where I interview creators about their games and inspirations and about the theory, process and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, your host today and always, and your friendly local indie enthusiast. September is, as always, International Podcast Month, and here at Yes Indeed Pod we like to celebrate with interviews with TTRPG podcasters. Today we're talking to Jeremy Gage of the Have You Played This Network, and most notably of the Draw Your Dice podcast. We've also talked about his science fantasy tactical card-based RPG, Last Breath, which I've enjoyed hearing about as part of Draw Your Dice. This was a great interview with a lot of really interesting points, so I won't keep it from you. And of course, now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. So, today we're talking to Jeremy Gage. Hi there, Jeremy, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Marks. It's good to talk to you again. I know that I've had you on my show as well.
Yes, quite a while ago now, actually. I mean, it must have been 18 months ago. It does feel like a long time ago.
Long time friends. Long time friends.
We've been engaging a bit more recently because I've been in a couple of the spaces you're in, like your Discord server and the Brain Trust server, which is much fun. Mm-hmm. Jeremy, would you like to introduce yourself and let us know what you do in the indie tabletop role-playing game scene?
Sure, I'd love to. So, hello everyone. My name is Jeremy Gage. I am the host of the Draw Your Dice podcast, as well as a member of the Have You Played This Network with Adam Bell, where you can find some of our tabletop discussion things over on twitch.tv/AdamEBell, or it might be /playedthisnow at this point. I'm not sure. One of those two things are true. Additionally, I also do design work. I've helped with other people's game designs and sort of like a consultation slash developmental editing or writing capacity or faculty. And I'm also working on my own tactical RPG now called Last Breath.
Ah, I see. It's been a while since I heard any of the devlogs of that. So I didn't know you'd been like freelancing design work as well. Are you able to tell us who you've been working for, or is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't sign NDAs.
Neither do I.
I did a GM thing for Spencer Campbell's Nova. I did an adventure for Down We Go, the Bog Pit. That's about it on like a major capacity, and then just doing like little consults here or there with people about, you know, where their game's going and, you know, everything like that.
Fabulous. Yeah. Tell us about Last Breath.
It is a attempt at finding an answer to the mechanics or current design philosophies around tactical skirmish games like D&D 5e, Pathfinder, and things of those nature.
Yeah.
I wanted to create something where character combat mechanics are very lateral, where you can kind of sub out different things. It's turned into a deck builder, so you'll build a deck of abilities and cards. It's very akin to like Slay the Spire in that sense.
Interesting.
If anyone's played that video game.
It's familiar.
Additionally,
to me, yeah.
I wanted progression to be about the world, not about the players. We have a ton of power fantasy, like growth and power fantasy games out there. Mm. And I really want the quote unquote power, quote unquote fantasy to kind of go to the setting rather than the individual characters.
Okay.
So that when a GM takes that world, it's kind of like a legacy game in a way that if a group of players does something to the world, you can then take that history point and play it with another group or create new characters and play from that point forward, or maybe explore a past point and work towards another present point or future point, but just kind of like really letting the world be the thing that gains experience because of your involvement.
Are you intending to make that as a sort of living campaign
mm-hmm.
that is connected across different game groups then.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's super cool.
I think that there's definitely experience where it's community driven.
Oh, that's really cool. I've listened to a lot of your podcast, and quite often you talk about using web tools and internet tools and, you know, connectivity mm-hmm. tools to kind of change what TTRPGs feel like and make them a bit more like what MMORPGs feel like. I mean, is that the sort of thing that you want to build into Last Breath?
Absolutely. You know, I've had some conversations recently about, you know, this has turned into a deck builder, and I love that it's a deck builder. But card production, along with multiple asset pieces for a tactical game, physically can be expensive and to get it to different people. I also recently had a conversation with the designers from Navathim's End. Their names are Sin and Pam. I don't remember their surnames currently. Yeah, Sin and Pam. They're both super wonderful from the Philippines. And one of the things we talked about in that episode, in the Philippines, they don't really have great access to physical product. It's really a big, you know, excuse my French for any younger listeners, but it's a huge pain in the ass to get something delivered to the Philippines or even between islands because of how their customs operations and mailing system works.
Right.
It's actually, and the cost of it is insane. They even mentioned, I think in the episode, that it's cheaper to triangulate a shipping between people who live in the Philippines, by using the Philippines, giving it to a friend in the United States, and then having that friend in the United States send it back to the Philippines, which seems bonkers to me. They talked about how they're used to using bookmarks and PDFs and using backlinks and things like that to operate their games and using character sheets from their phones and everything of that nature. And that was just a breath of fresh air to me, because I think that in the States or in more like European centric countries, we have sort of this entitlement or privilege about physical items. Like, I hear people all the time be like, oh, I could never play a game that I can't like hold the book in my hand.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's a luxury, right? Like, books are kind of a luxury in a way, especially physical ones. And with the whole shipping mess from the last 2 years and distribution becoming more expensive and everything like that, and Amazon stuff, and also being in the distribution pipeline of waste, right? Creating cardboard, plastic, bubble wrap, cards, stickers, glue, like all that stuff gets discarded immediately upon package opening.
Yeah.
And so for me, digital is kind of an attempt at saying, A, it doesn't have to be print to be successful, though I'm sure I will feel the pain points of not having physical cards, but we see success stories with Hearthstone, with Legends of Runeterra, with online Gwent and stuff like that.
Sure.
Where they have a huge fan base, and they do things digitally for card games that you could never do physically. So the long answer is yes. I definitely intend to bring sort of a digital first approach to the game, whether that be like a mobile app or a desktop app or something like that.
I think that's really wonderful and really interesting as well. I mean, one of the ways that I was like quite heavily involved with the role-playing game scene was with a living mush. It sounds really ancient, like it's the kind of tech you had in the 80s, but actually this was like 10 years ago. And like, that's a really interesting thing, because everybody connects and they all have like different plot arcs, and you know, they go around and have different encounters and combat things and, you know, so on. And all through that, there are a couple of GMs who are like driving this big meta story through there. And it's a living world in the respect that that meta arc should define what everybody else plays, and that's kind of a role-playing game approach to it, in a way that, you know, like, I don't know, Final Fantasy 14 and World of Warcraft have done for many, many years. And it's also interesting in a different way. I know you're a big FF14 player, and I think that's it's really interesting how you are eliding that tech with role-playing game tech.
There's a lot we can learn backwards from, you know, they learned from the initial role-playing games of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and then created their video games.
Yeah.
Now we have an opportunity to learn from them, and it is definitely like a trials by fire, trying to get those mechanics to feel right. And there are games that have tried or continue to try. I have like my eyes on this game that's going to kickstart apparently in the fourth quarter, called Sengokushin Five Sacrifices. It's your standard campaign game, like Gloomhaven kind of, but after listening to some more of the recent episodes, I know that you're a fan of sort of nonviolent solutions to encounters with other beings. And
someone listened to the Worldlings episode today. Yeah.
Yeah. In that game, they have sort of two methods of, there's like these 12 boss characters they revealed so far. There's not like multiple enemies you fight, just whenever you, it's kind of like a Monster Hunter approach.
Yeah.
Slash Elden Ring kind of has this energy where there's these kind of major players that you encounter more than like smaller enemies.
Mm.
But when you encounter one of these other beings, these creatures, if you will, they have two decks. They have a combat deck and they have a psychology deck. And you can play towards either one. All the designers for Senkakushin are psychologists in their day lives. And the way that you interact with the psychology deck changes how maybe combat encounters go, or that you do combat counters at all. And those are also things I want to bring to Last Breath in the terms of like almost like an auto battle optional rule of like, hey, if you don't want to engage in like moment to moment combat and you're not trying to have like a violent altercation with someone, here's a quick optional rule for faster resolution slash like it doesn't have to play out in cuts and bruises. It can play out in like just high stakes intimidation, like standoff sort of stuff. Like we could go to combat, but let's reason it out.
I'm very down with that, because sometimes I think whilst combat can be quite fun, I did used to enjoy Pathfinder a lot. I have sort of moved beyond that, I think, in what I enjoy at least. And it's nice to have the option.
I'm also looking for a way to like touch on that non-violent things. But I think for me, what I enjoy about those combat games like Pathfinder and D&D, though they don't quite do it, but you get in like a lot of video games, is skill mastery and build mastery of like finding mechanical synergies. So I love like when my build comes together, I'm like, oh yeah, big number. Ooh, mama.
That's interesting in a deck builder game, isn't it? I don't know if Magic the Gathering kind of counts as a deck builder game. I guess it's not quite the same thing. You're doing the same thing. You're trying to make mechanical synergies between different ways of playing that game and engaging. I'm talking really off the cuff because it's been probably 20 years since I played Magic the Gathering, but I think it must be really interesting to be able to build a deck that you know is going to work from one or two different angles, but all of the cards are kind of driving towards that same thing. And it's the same with like building very optimized build in Pathfinder, isn't it? It's the same type of thing.
Yeah, everyone's trying to Nova their brains out. The other thing that I am sort of designing against in terms of the current trend of skirmish battlers is medieval fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we have a lot of quick resolution games, and I consider anything a quick resolution game that doesn't involve like a minutia combat, right? Like,
yeah,
combat in of itself I see as a resolution mechanic that has like 100 steps, right, between movement, attacking, blocking, whatever have you.
Yeah.
And then quick resolution is like your Blades in the Dark, your PBTA sort of stuff, even if there is like quote unquote combat. But they all seem to be really tied up in the traditional medieval fantasy sort of genre, high fantasy. Even if there's like a steampunk element or something like that, it all feels very sword and shield energy. So for Last Breath, I wanted to try to push a more futuristic approach to it while still maintaining the fantasy of like trite tropes like elements and the concepts of fey or constructs or demons and devils and angels and all those sorts of fantasy tropes, but just kind of push them in a future direction.
Is it more like Numenera, or is it more like Shadowrun? Or
it is less Shadowrun, probably a little more Numenera.
Cool.
But not as weird. I think one of Numenera's failings for me, it's true, because it's, I've seen this from a couple of people online, that Numenera is like creatures and the things that like are a part of its world proper. Just being able to describe those things to your players is very difficult because they're eldritch in nature, right? Like, how do you describe?
I'm not big into it. Yeah, it's too weird.
Yeah. When I say like, oh, it's an orc, everyone has sort of like a baggaged disposition for what an orc is, right? But if I say this thing is a Zangle Grasp, you're like, what what the fuck is that? What is that? And yeah. Then you try to describe it, and it's like, oh, it's got like five tentacles and a big mouth, but the mouth is on like the belly. It's like, okay. At that point, everyone's at a different stage of imagination.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyways, yes, it's a little bit more in the Numenera direction, but not as weird in terms of alienness of it, a little less alien.
Yeah.
So the idea is that the world is made up of these two giant mechs, a giant knight and a giant dragon mech that are at a scale to which the people who live on them don't really know what they are. Like, they can't even comprehend the shape based on their size.
Wild.
It is kind of off the concept of Xenoblade Chronicles. If you've played that game, or if any of the audience has played those games, the first Xenoblade, the world is made up of these two battling like humanoid mechs. One has like slashed a sword into the torso, and that creates a bridge between the two mechs. And that's the world, essentially. Over time, the magical energies of it have created like rock formations and plants to grow on them, and has like miraculously spawned fauna and flora and people on it. So that's the direction that I wanted to go in for this, that there are these giant technological, almost godlike wonders that create this continent set, and then people have just sort of spawned on that. And right now, the playable cultures, I don't like to say the word races because I think that's diminishing, sort of the cultures or forms or shapes, I guess, is what I more say. The shapes you can currently play as are these mechanical angels who are, you know, if you like Asimars and D&D, you'll love these shapes. The mechs have like, their dungeons are called vaults.
Yeah.
And there are these guardian angels, these knights of the round table, because I wanted to put some Arthurian like fantasy elements in there. And they guard the vaults. And there are some of them that have like grown a different consciousness as time has gone on in their dormancy. Oh, I should say, the two giant godlike mech beings, the reason why the game's called Last Breath is because they're in their last death throes before they went dormant. Like, the night one had stabbed the dragon, the dragon's like reaching up for like a claw to the face, and then they just sort of stop, and that's when like the genesis occurs. So these angels protect the insides of the night for their dungeons, and some of them have grown their own consciousness over time because of how the different energies of the dragon and the knight and the sword have all sort of interacted together.
Yeah.
Then there are the Starfall demons, which are these meteorites that smashed into the dragon over time, and they have sort of absorbed its blood or its oil, whatever sort of like narrative you want to put on that. They have turned into these like demonic, crystalline, glimmering, like, you could be a demon made of ruby or something like that, or made of sapphires and jade or whatever. Because that's what Meteor Rock is made of. And then the last one are Chromatic Fae, which are flora and fauna aesthetically set and very colorful beings. You could be like a sort of a red-tinted shape with deer protrusions or deer aesthetics, and maybe like a little bit of like flowers growing out of your shoulders or your hair or something like that.
That's really cool.
And so that's kind of like the general setting. And then everything's very like high technology in terms of like motorcycles, communication devices, all the weapons have sort of like a future push on them.
That sounds really cool.
Thank you.
The demons thing reminds me of this really weird book, and this is a complete aside, you know, I don't expect you to respond to this, but it reminds me of this really weird book I read when I was younger, which was called The Jade Demon Quartet, which was like quite high fantasy, but also kind of horny. So it was very weird.
Awakening, got it.
bizarre. Anyway, so all of that sounds really fun. What sort of production timescale are you looking at for that at the moment?
Oh God. Lord.
I know, I'm so a terrible human.
It's a great question. And I think this is also nice because, so I'm a new designer. The whole reason I started Draw Your Dice, if, you know, this could be also an excellent segue point to that, but the reason I started the podcast is so that I could learn game design, because I wasn't finding what I needed on the internet. Like, not in a way that made sense to my sort of left brain approach to creation. A lot of the stuff that I was finding was very high level, abstract, like, oh, when I design a game, I look at its theme, and like theme can mean a ton of things to different people. And I think theme is very important now in my later. But at the beginning, it was like, I just don't understand what everyone is saying. Like, I feel I'm in a cigar lounge where there are a bunch of people in red velvet robes who are philosophers, and they're just talking about some laws and principles that are going way over my head. And like, not in a way that I couldn't grasp them, but just it's so esoteric. And so I started the podcast to like absorb all of that. And that's kind of when I started noodling on a design idea. And I bounced back and forth between a ton of stuff. But so far I've been in design of just the combat system for maybe the last 9 months, 9 to 10 months now. However, because I want this to also be a part of the game, the one thing, again, this is against D&D because that's like my major trad fantasy touch point. But one of the things I don't like about D&D and sort of like Pathfinder is the skill list system, and that there are these two, there's a mode and then there's a half mode for the games. There's combat, which the game is designed to do. It's designed to do it what it thinks is well. And I'm not trying to say that to like yuck yums. I'm just trying to say that like, I don't find their particular combat design fulfilling, but then I don't love how there's these very, very minor mechanics around role play setting or prompt setting. And I know maybe some of that, you know, there's some guys in the boardroom who are like, well, let's let it be emergent. Let's let them figure out what a 16 versus a 14 means on a D20. And I think that's fine if you're into that, but I just want a little bit more meat there. There's so many games out there that have that meat. When we look at things like Blades in the Dark and how it articulates the difference between like a 1 to 3, a 4, a 5, a 6. There's stuff with PBTA that really sets up those things nicely. Navathim's End does it nicely. Even though it's sort of similar, Arc Doom by Momedos is also like really interesting how it approaches the skills list. And those are still like very quick resolution systems.
Yeah.
But that's all to say that this is a full circle to the production question. I'm designing the game in such a way that it's modular.
Okay.
If you wanted to play in the universe but didn't want combat, I want that to be possible. I want you to be able to remove the resolution mechanic of combat at your choice, at your table, and engage with still the world building, leveling up, and the social role play prompt setting, and play those two games. So really, I'm kind of designing three games, and the first combat game is probably going to see its like public alpha within the next 2 months.
Oh, that's quite soon. When I asked that question, and you know, your initial response was, oh, what a terrible question. You know, I expected you to be like, I don't know, maybe sometime in the next 10 years.
I mean, that's possibly true for all three, because I don't think I would like release the game proper until all three systems were kind of like survived kicking the tires. But I'm basically designing a combat game, a social game, and a world building toolkit that you can sort of like couple or decouple as you please.
Well, it sounds really fun. And I'm really hoping that maybe future listeners will be able to go out and buy Jeremy Gage's Last Breath. And
crossing fingers.
We've kind of segued into talking about Draw Your Dice. So Draw Your Dice is a great podcast. I want to tell everybody that. And I, you know, if you listen to Yes Indeed Pod and you enjoy it, I think you will enjoy Draw Your Dice because it has a similar mood. I think it is one of the, you know, it's a really well-produced podcast. You have very interesting guests. You have very interesting questions. You've got a really nice format. Tell us about it from your point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know this will be the first place I say it. Everyone, please listen. There's not really too much in terms of ads on there, so it's kind of a freeform show. Like I said, Draw Your Dice was the first content child I ever had to do a couple of things. A, selfishly learn game design from other people, to absorb an hour of their time and absorb their knowledge and learn their ways of doing things to adapt it to my own skill set. And I will not deny that. And I've said that pretty much from day one.
Yeah.
But B, it was also an opportunity to lift up people who were not getting asked onto podcasts. People who weren't hitting like quota numbers of interest or have the confidence to reach out to people and ask to be on their podcast. So I wanted to reach out to diverse individuals who needed just a little push to be like, you can ask people to be on their show. It is within you, and the worst they can say is no. And that will not deject from you or who you are in any capacity.
Sure.
So that was one of the other reasons. The last one was to try to also create, you know, like a business for myself or some sort of income stream that could help support me and my partner in even a little bit of a way.
Yeah.
And again, that's also something that I haven't denied since the inception of the show.
Yeah.
Because currently I have to participate in the capitalism game and I can't pay for my electricity on airwaves.
Yeah. So that's a mood.
And it does take some time. As you know, Marks, and as Alex knows and any other podcasters that we've had on either of our shows, like, this requires dedicated time to execute between editing, sound design, scheduling, administration stuff, publishing, republishing, checking in with people.
Yeah, it's work. It is.
And it's also free marketing for people.
And it is work. It is tough. And it takes a lot to make a single episode. I think recently I put out an announcement that Yes Indeed Pod will be coming to a close at the end of the year. And it's partly because every episode takes me about 8 hours to make. And that's quite a lot of time, you know. Maybe I'm not very efficient, but that's how I want to do it. It's how I want to make it. And for me, I want to make sure that it's good quality to get across the ideas that the people I'm talking to are trying to get across.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't dedicate 16 to 30 hours of every month to running a podcast like that. So yeah, that's why mine's coming to an end. But I think it's really important that podcasters do talk about how much work it is so that people don't automatically assume that it's dead easy.
Well, if it was dead easy, they would be doing their own podcast, right?
Maybe there's too much of that. I mean, I have a lot of respect for people who make interview podcasts in particular, because I think it's a real skill to be able to talk to people.
Yeah.
We were kind of talking about different approaches to interviewing. Like, mine is very laissez-faire. I just go with the flow, whatever, which is why I'm now floundering around for some questions. No, not really. Yours seems to be quite well planned. You talk to people about their games in a very informed way. I think that's really interesting. And do you think it's important to talk about a game honestly and with a level of critique? Or do you think it's important to let people talk about their own stuff and bring out their own ideas and understand their point of view rather than your interpretation of their point of view?
First of all, great question.
It's a tough question.
Glad we got there. For me, when I design the show, like I said, I'm looking to download their brain.
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of both for me. I want to put a lot of effort into understanding the game. I think I have a nice developed skill at this point where I could like read a mechanic on a game or read like the coupling of mechanics. Like, oh, I understood what you did there.
Yeah.
Or I understood what like the context of what you were trying to go for.
Yeah.
And then be excited about that. I don't think I've ever had anyone on the show where I've balked at an idea or even like really critiqued something. I think there might have been maybe one or two episodes where I mentioned something about like maybe not liking a particular mechanic or thinking about what kind of dangers a certain mechanic or a certain setup can cause at play culture of a table. Like often we talk about like quarterbacking. So that, I don't think that was it, but that's an example of something I would bring up. Like, do you ever worry about quarterbacking with this particular mechanic or et cetera, et cetera? For me, it was always about letting the person be excited about what they created, especially, again, trying to bring that a less limelit designer, let them talk about why they're excited about what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because the only reason someone has created something is because they can't find it somewhere else. They can't get quite the right amount of satisfaction from the things that are already out there.
Sure.
So they made their own mental model of something, of an experience that they have that no one else can tap into, like the designs by The Dice, the Plural System who created Swamp Creature 2E, I think that they all just did. And like, I didn't know Plural Systems existed until I had met them and read their game and understood or gained an understanding of where they were coming from in their design and who they were as a system, essentially, or as like an inner community. And so it's stuff like that that I wanted the show to focus on, was the elements of letting them be excited to talk about the things they find exciting. In fact, one of the questions that I'm sure people will have tagged on to is that probably in about half the episodes, I ask, what is the mechanic you love the most about this game?
Yes.
Or what is the thing you love most about the game? Because that's the thing they were trying to share with you. The reader, the player, that's what they were trying to get to you.
Yeah.
And if at that point you go to get that game and read nothing else but that and take an understanding away from that to enhance your own skill set, my job's complete. I've done my educational duty on draw your dice.
Like, that educational angle is, in general, is something that comes across really strongly and is, like, very clear that you've designed the show to educate not only the listener, but also yourself. And I really like the level of honesty that you have about your understanding of how to make role-playing games. I think that's really fascinating. Like, you've talked to a lot of people about the entire process in a way that maybe I don't get involved with so much. And I think that's really cool. So not only do you speak to people about, oh, how do you do mechanical design? How do you do narrative design? But you also ask people, well, how do you manage your projects? Like, we had a really long conversation about project management and community management. But also, like, how do you physically go out there and publish a book? Like, what are the steps involved? I think that's really good. Yeah. And it's a really important oral history, if you like, you know, to be able to to pass on to people, because there's so much that new designers need to know, and it's quite difficult to find that in a condensed format. But here you are, the condensed milk of podcasting.
So thick. Someone said it best to me the other, like, a couple weeks ago or something like that. Like, but my attempt is to demystify game design. You don't necessarily have to go to college for game theory. No. And if you feel like that, then I hope that I can provide enough vocab, terminology, interconnections through my guests and through the show that you can grasp even a little bit of understanding that allows you to start applying it. Because some people are going to be in their late 20s, early 30s, early 40s, late 40s, and, like, pick up design and want to make a game, and it's going to seem like such a chore to even get through your first one. There's an anime that I watched a while back where, oh, it was My Hero Academia. There's an episode or a chapter, spoilers for My Hero Academia if you're not caught up with the anime or the manga. I'm sure. Gonna give you 3 seconds. There's an episode where one of the teachers, Eraser, his student Shiro, the one that can do the mind control, the kid was so frustrated with using the bandage techniques that Eraser uses in his combat. It's like, it's so frustrating. It took you 4 years to develop this fighting style. How am I supposed to learn it? And he goes, well, it's because I'm here. I can share 4 years of experience with you in 2 months. Like, I've refined the process, and now I can distill it to you.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important to realize is that you don't necessarily have to start from zero. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't have connections in the space, so they don't have, like, another designer friend to talk to. Or if they do, that designer friend may not be at a different level that can kind of assist them in that way. Like, they can both sort of, like, fumble together and both start from zero, and that can be its own unique experience. But to have a mentor that can sort of give you quick, like, oh, those mechanics don't really work together because of X, or I can see your themings here. Do you think, like, rolling dice serves the game, or do you think it's getting in the way of the play? I just think it's important to realize that.
I think that's really interesting, because what you're saying is that you're taking the life experiences that have led to people being good game designers, which, you know, could be just the time that they were designing games, but it's unlikely to be. So you're condensing probably millennia worth of experiences into 100 hours plus of podcast that could teach you pretty substantially what it is like, at least in one tradition of game design, to design games, what that means and what that should look like, and, like, the boots on the ground way of doing that. That's kind of incredible, isn't it, what podcasts and this distillation of knowledge and experience is able to do. I think that's pretty cool anyway.
You know? Thank you. That was the goal, just to, like I said, to demystify it. It's really important. It's not that spooky, but it can, you know, there are people who believe that you shouldn't, like, put vocab to game design because it hinders the creativity of the space. And I guess I am of a controversial mind then at that point, that I think having a shared language increases the rate at which learning can occur for any particular industry.
I think there's ways and means, aren't there? Like, artists will have a shared visual language, or, like, musicians will have a shared musical language and so on. You know, there's not a reason not to put terminology on things, and some people will find that really helpful and some personalities will find that really hindering, and like it's just ways and means of dealing with things. Like I think some people probably are by their nature very good at game design, like, and some people will have excellent ideas about narrative design and what they want to get across, but may not necessarily have the terminology and tools to go out and build that. And mm-hmm. we have to cater to both people, you know.
yeah It doesn't ruin game design to have vocabulary.
It does not, no. Likewise, it does not necessarily make it the be-all and end-all to have full categorizations of games and yes. put terminology on everything, you know. Both things are important, and it's much about process as it is history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeremy, who do you think is the guest that you have learned the most from?
Huge question.
Small question. Huge answer.
Bold, huge. Let's see. I think this is going to be, all my guests have been great and they all have impacted me in some capacity, maybe in different intensities, but also maybe to different amounts as well. And that also depends on the time that they came onto the show. But I think that Spencer, because we share tactical minds, we share build minds, we share like mechanical minds in our games or in our attempts for games. So I learned a lot from Spencer when he first came on the show. I learned a lot from Adam Bell, who has been my partner in crime on the Have You Played This Discord space. What I learned from Adam was the concept of trusting the table to play your game and also to take considerations of all the experiences that could be touching on your game.
Yeah.
In the trad space, people are really up in arms about the term race or using races and having bioessentialism occur in a game. For learning from Adam, it goes a little bit beyond that, like thinking about mental challenges like ADHD or different cognitive loads that people can take on.
Yeah.
And so it helps to really think about how to streamline your mechanics so that people can understand your game at a basic level without too much lift. I think the last one would probably be, I can't remember who started the itch funding conversation.
Was it Jeff?
I think Jeff was one that we talked a lot about it, but Jeff wasn't the first one we were talking about.
No, it wasn't.
With.
No, you're right.
I'll think of this person and maybe I can tack it onto a tweet or something later. But sure. It was also the conversation around there are different ways to do business that wasn't Kickstarter. Because at first, when I started learning from people about game design, Kickstarter was the end all be all. Mm. You made it if you could put a game on Kickstarter and succeed, right? There was no other way to like get the game off the ground, at least from what my understanding was. And people who may listen to both of our shows and have been a guest, like, oh, well, I didn't, you know, if you're thinking that, oh, I didn't really like mean that when I was saying it or et cetera, et cetera. That is my intuitions as an outside observer to Twitter, to Discords, and to all my guests. If you didn't do something on Kickstarter, you weren't like making a successful attempt at your game.
Yeah.
And that was spooky to me because like Kickstarter was also sounding like something that was a monster and emotionally damaging to people on a large scale, like with all the super backer BS and things. And I'm sure you experienced this in some capacity with Far Horizons. Like you probably go through tons of Kickstarter hoops, not only with that, but with like revenue sharing between different people.
Yeah.
It's a monster task, an absolute monster task, it seems like. And so when we got into the conversations around itch funding, I think it was actually Keegan who brought it up first. Cause Keegan did it with Necromancer.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, Keegan.exe. Yeah, it was the conversation around itch funding that showed me that. It also made me think more about business in terms of there are different ways to execute if you just give it a little brain power. If you don't just follow the metric of like, here's your attempt at the lottery ticket, right? I think that's what Kickstarter is to me now. Yeah. I think Kickstarter feels like a lottery ticket. You can give your $5,000 like goal and hope for like, oh, wow, we got 60K or whatever. Or, you know, you'll end up being like, okay, we got 5K for 5K. Cool. Those would be my three conversations around tactics, conversations around design, empathetical towards the potential players at your table. And then that there are different business models than what everyone says is successful.
Very good answer and extremely diplomatic. So I appreciate that. We've danced a little bit around this, but it sounds like Draw Your Dice may be potentially coming to an end.
It's something I'll announce myself once I get the last few episodes together, but is it okay if I soapbox?
Yeah, please soapbox. That is what we're here for.
Okay, well, I hope so. And again, my opinions are my own. There are many of my peers and colleagues, Mark's included, who have their own opinions about podcasting in the indie game space, but here we go. This is probably going to be the last year for Draw Your Dice, and there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that as a venture, as a business venture, I have felt that the podcast is not a good use of my time and has sort of failed in that regard, partially because of me and my lack of experience in running a business or figuring out how to do the influencer content creator business model or the different business models that surround that. I think I'm a much wiser person now. When I start my next venture, I think I'll be much better off for it.
Yeah.
But the other part that I want to soapbox about it is the framing of tabletop RPG podcasts. At the end of the day, at least to me, whether or not our shows are about education, entertainment, or inspiration, they are also a marketing tool. They might as well be their own social medias in a lot of regards, in combination with our Discord servers, our Twitter profiles, our Instagrams, the YouTubes that we side upload to.
Yeah.
Anytime someone approaches us about their games, it is an opportunity as evergreen content for their game to get another consumer. And I think that's something that we want to do as podcast hosts. That's something that I wanted to do when I started, is to lift up those other creators and spotlight them so that they can make a little extra money. I think it's important to support the community in that way. But Draw Your Dice started to take this weird transactional transition into, I was getting emails from people about, hey, I've got this game coming up. It's going to Kickstarter soon. If you've been one of these people and I've had you on the show, I have no ill will toward you. If you're listening to this and you've sent me an email of that type, we're cool. We're super fine. We're still good friends. I'm happy to chat with you. But it was taking this weird angle to where I was getting emails from people about, hey, we have a Kickstarter coming up, et cetera, et cetera. And I had moved to a position that I wanted to release the show bi-weekly, and I had already made some promises of dates to other episodes.
Yeah.
So when they'd say, you know, my Kickstarter is coming up in May and it would be like April or something like that. Like, unfortunately, I already have a bunch of episodes pegged for May at this point, just to keep my own like consistent schedule. I probably won't be able to get yours out until like June or July or something like that. It's like, oh, that's not going to do it for us. We were really hoping that we could get out in May, but totally understand. Thanks for your time. Like, that email is a marketing email. It is an approach to get enough buzz about your game for it to succeed. And that's not what Draw Your Dice was meant to be. It was meant to be an educational resource for people who wanted to learn game design, not to be a digital billboard.
Absolutely. I understand that.
And it just became really transactional. And the other thing was to cultivate relationships with people from across the internet, because we were in COVID. I didn't really have a play group. I joined the Brain Trust of like November 2019, and I wanted to make friends. I wanted to put myself out there and say, hey, Jeremy Gage is here. He wants to talk to you. He wants to hear about your games. He wants to make friends, right? Like, that was my approach. But it started to move into a point where I wouldn't talk to people for weeks, months, a whole year in some respect. At some point, I had like made one or two changes with hosting platforms. I had changed from like Anchor to Red Circle and then over to Acast, and some episodes got lost in translation. And so every once in a while, like, hey, I was checking the feed and I didn't see my episode in there. I'm like, hey, how are you? Like, I'm glad we could have a conversation before you hit me with that, which we didn't. And so it's like, what did our experience mean to you? Was it just so that you could get another set of ears or eyeballs on your product? Because that's kind of fucked up to me. Now, if I designed the podcast to be in sort of that affiliate mindset,
I see where you're going.
That would, I would have a much different energy, but like, Draw Your Dice would be going forward nonstop with affiliate links.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that wasn't what it was about. Absolutely. Additionally, the second thing that I think podcasting has a bad framing around is compensation. Yeah. When people propose that they're going to do a Kickstarter for their game and they set some sort of goal, they've considered the following plus other things. They've considered what the art is going to cost them. They've considered what expansion materials are going to cost them or supplemental materials. They've done a budget for any additional merch, like shirts or hats or whatever have you.
Yeah.
Compensation for writers, compensation for Kickstarter, like Kickstarter's cut or whatever.
Yeah.
Never have I ever seen a consideration for a marketing budget, which tons of other companies do. Now, here's the thing. I understand that to pay an amount of money forward on a platform that is precedented on only giving you money should you meet your goal is a little spooky. But I would also argue that you've probably made some initial payments for concept art for the Kickstarter or initial quick start materials with other writers. So when there is no self-supporting market for us as podcasters, like a lot of, ad revenue, right? Or outside sources, we have to get fucking Purple Mattress ads. We have to get Amazon affiliate links. We have to be at the random whims of AdSense or get sponsorships from Notion or Hulu or something like that, right? It's outside. It's not supported by our own industry, but everything else is supported by our industry. Everyone will pay, the consumer will pay money because of the people who are part of the project or whatever have you, or they like the concept. Yeah. So when I go to people who don't fit my need for a diverse set of guests, like it's someone who's already been mildly successful to some capacity that doesn't have a good, it's just a cold open, and they go, hey, can we put our game on your show? I'm like, cool. This is basically, I tell them, this is a sponsored episode. You're asking me to market for you. You're asking to be a guest on here in a capacity that is not educational, but is self-serving to you. That's going to cost you $150. And we don't really have the budget for that. Why? Why do you not have the budget for that if you're running the Kickstarter for it?
Mm.
The budget is whatever you make the budget to be.
Yeah.
If your budget is $5,000 and you kick another $500 on there, you've paid for five different podcasts to be on or YouTube channels or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, it's one of those things where it's short-term versus long-term conversations. There's actually a lot of Twitter discourse about this a while back that I kind of, on the designer side, there's this really strange conversation happening about, would you ever send a free game to a podcaster? There were so many, I would say the words more successful designers, because they either have had really big Kickstarters or they put out a lot of games with successful Kickstarts. And you're like, I would never send a free game with someone who didn't have the clout for it. I'm like, first of all, hold on one second. Do you understand what a podcast episode is doing for you so long as you haven't been canceled by the entire industry? It is going to live there for forever, so long as the internet exists, which means it is a constant opportunity for someone to pick up your game. I'm listening to old RPG, Backstory by Alex Roberts is a perfect example. That hasn't been in production for forever, but people still fondly listen to that show and still pick it up at random. And so if they did the same with Draw Your Dice, any opportunity to hear about Down We Go, to hear about Nova, to hear about, and these are all from people that I love. I'm not trying to point out anyone that I'm having ill feelings about or something.
Good.
I'm not here to shame anyone publicly on the podcast, but it's that Nova episode continues to exist. People continue to listen to the show or pick up the show. I see a little bit of analytics here and there where I get a new subscriber or new listener, unique listen.
Yeah.
Maybe two every month or something like that.
Yeah.
That's potentially still two sales or two new fans of Spencer's, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so the non-consideration for supporting podcasters in our sphere, to me, is asinine. Absolutely asinine. And for the conversation to be around, you don't have enough clout for me to warrant giving you a free version of my game. For me, I can't say that anyone's done this to me, but I've seen the Twitter discourse about it, and it was so one-sided. But I need that review copy. And oftentimes if I, at the time of making or starting Draw Your Dice, I never really had the money to pay for things. So it was kind of like a beggar's, please give me a game. I'd love to have a really in-depth conversation about what you made here today. Yeah, otherwise, you're just going to be holding my hand the whole show, and that's not very entertaining to anyone. And when I could pay for it, I absolutely went back and threw a couple dollars to the creator because they spent time on that, and that's, you know, that's what it costs. So for someone to balk at me about like having their episode when they have a Kickstarter up that has a budget that you created, that you put a specific monetary value for, and then you get a little poopy about it, I'm just not interested anymore. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And yeah. I understand that that could be a guest-to-guest thing, but overall, that's just what Draw Your Dice has ended up becoming known for. It's a place where people get to talk about their games, and it's become now a billboard space instead of a conversational space.
I understand all that. Yeah, I definitely have experienced that, people emailing you, sending you spam through your contact form and just endlessly asking, can I come on the podcast? And at first I would respond to everyone and say yes or no, and it's gotten to the point where I feel like I can't even respond to them because there's so many now, you know.
Yeah.
And it's fine if you want to have a conversation with me about it. And like I've always said, I want you to come and talk about your cool stuff. I don't have the same mission statement as you, you know. But it does increasingly feel very transactional. Now, I have seen some people, and Nick Bate was a really good example of this, put up that they did have marketing budget in their Kickstarter campaigns.
Yeah, I remember that.
It wasn't a lot, but it was nice, you know. And they said how much they'd paid for an advert on my show, which is not a huge amount of money. And actually, I really appreciate that because it shows that we are trying to cover our costs as well. Like, I was in a position where I didn't mind paying for the show because it was my hobby and I was enjoying doing it. But it does get to the point where if I want to support my guests and the people I invite onto the show, I offer them a fee. I say to them, I can do this because I'm being supported by my Patreon subscribers. But guess what? If we didn't have to do that and people offered us money to sponsor the shows to advertise their stuff in perpetuity, maybe the space would look a little bit different. So I totally understand where you're coming from.
I know that there are other people that feel similar to me, but I think that I have a special bias towards it or a special friction to it because I don't necessarily have like a 9-to-5 that's kind of supporting me. Both me and my partner are very creatively driven individuals, and we have burnt out on our 20s of doing jobs that we just don't really. I did restaurant industry work for like 10 years, and that was very stressful to me based on doing the different types of jobs, working until like, you know, anywhere from 10 to 4 in the morning from a 16-hour shift or something and have to do it all again the next day, not having time to think or to create, just to survive, and only making enough money that lets me live basically paycheck to paycheck with no real room for growth unless someone quits, gets fired, or dies. You know, I'm just sensitive to that sort of stuff, and I've seen a ton of people that just will not find their creation space because their brains are so overloaded with work.
Yes.
So when I hear that you don't have the budget to help with marketing, I can get pretty shitty about it. Like, not, you know, I'm not sending mean emails to people. It's like, I see how you operate. I see what you see me as, and I don't like it.
I don't know. This is a sort of trope about influencers like trying to get stuff for free, right? It's that kind of level of assumed privilege, like just because you are a person who maybe can get 10,000 people to look at something, it doesn't necessarily mean that you should get something for free. And it's a similar feeling, I think. I do have mixed feelings about what you said there, but I absolutely appreciate 100% why you have decided to opt for the route that you have done, because, you know, everyone's lifestyle is valid, right?
Like I said at the top of this, my opinions are my own, and even though I've heard similar like aches and pains from other podcasters, they don't have to share my experience or necessarily agree with where I'm coming from, or even my attitude toward it, because it could be a difference of, my partner explained this like really nice word with something else we were talking about creatively, but grit. They have this really nice like amount of giving grit where they want to support the person. That's sort of like their value. They want to service others, which is also really important. And when I say service others, I don't mean like in a submissive role, but like you took a position in your community to help others. That is the role you gave to yourself.
Yeah.
And I know that people won't like let themselves be taken advantage of, which it sounds like you haven't, right? Like you've gotten enough emails and spam contact form things. You're like, I said no to this, which is not submissive. It is, I chose not to do that.
Yeah.
And there just may be a difference of my, I don't even want to use the word charity because that just makes it seem like otherworldly, but just the grit of being servicing to others. The stakes aren't that high for giving away to people for different individuals. And for me, the stakes are a little bit higher because I don't have the income to support that amount of work towards giving someone else their luxuries.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. It's that kind of idea of putting on your own mask before someone else's, right?
Yeah.
Kudos to you for making that decision. And that is a really strong position to take. And I am very respectful of that. So,
Thank you. I appreciate it. But, that you know, I'll be, there's a YouTube channel I'm starting in the next couple weeks here that's going to be still educational content.
Right.
It's just not going to be as interview focused.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to that. What name is that going to be under?
Just my name. Yeah. Makes it easy.
On that note, Jeremy, thank you for taking us through all of those things. Do you want to tell us where we can find you on the internet?
Yeah, absolutely. On Twitter, you can find me at Jeremy W. Gage. The W stands for Wenzel, if anyone wants to know.
I did. Thank you.
And my YouTube channel will be Jeremy Gage, or it might be Jeremy W. Gage, depending on what is more searchable, probably the W one. And that's really about it. And then you can also find me chattering in a bunch of different Discords. But if you want to come hang out in the HYPT Discord, you can find the link for that. You can find the link for the Discord over on the Have You Played This Twitch channel.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I guess all that remains for me to say is thank you very much for coming on Yes Indeed Pod. And good luck with your new YouTube venture.
Thank you, Marks. It was it's a pleasure to have been on here, and you're very sweet.
I try my best. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Jeremy for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. Next month is Spooky Month, and we'll be talking to at least two and maybe three creators about their weird, spooky, and maybe scary games in an effort to weed me onto horror games in general. Tune in 2 weeks to find out more. This week's episode has been kindly sponsored by Odin's Beard RPG. Stand true, gunslinger. We Deal in Lead is a hard-hitting Weird West Wonders adventure game of hardened gunslingers exploring a world that's moved on. Inspired by The Dark Tower by Stephen King, We Deal in Lead features streamlined D20 roll-under rules based on Cairn and Into the Odd, with dynamic and evocative art from Perplexing Ruins and Felipe Faria, among others. Set in a strange post-apocalyptic world eerily close to ours, where the borders of time and space wear thin, you are gunslingers, mythic champions holding off the forces of chaos with lead and grit. Fully compatible with Cairn and Into the Odd adventures or settings, journey with your gunslingers into other genres and times, or recruit heroes from other worlds to join your quest, even those fallen to death. After all, isn't death just another door? Join the Other Worlds Jam on Itch and create your own worlds for We Deal in Lead, or pre-order the hardcover now at buyodinsbeardrpg.com. This week, I'd like to thank some of my incredible Patreon supporters. Audrey Shankill, Thomas Elliott, Carl Rigney, Dono McCarthy, Craig Duffy, Dale Blackburn, and Alex Reinhardt. Thank you all so, so much. We couldn't do what we do without you. And you, yes, you can get a regular shout out and joyful thanks too if you go to patreon.com/yesindeedpod and sign up today. You'll get access to our Discord server where we can hang out and chat and even join monthly editing streams and the Yes Indeed Pod book club. Most of the money will go directly to creators rather than to me, so you'll be investing directly in the indie scene, helping to make it a healthy and inclusive place for years to come. And if you can't commit regularly, you can always help out by rating and reviewing the show wherever you find your podcasts, or by donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at yesindeedpod. That's YESINDIEDPOD. I'd love dearly to hear from you. And lastly, music credits. All music is taken from Be Quiet by Yatza from the Free Music Archive, released under Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 international license. Thanks, Yatza. And until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.